Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. A recent New York Times op-ed column celebrated Oklahoma's commitment to early childhood education. Since 1998, the state has provided free pre-kindergarten to all four-year-olds in the state. There are additional programs for some children in the 0-3 age range. It's estimated that every dollar spent in early childhood education saves society $7 in future costs in things like prisons and lost productivity. What happens to kids that aren't lucky enough to get a good education? When they come from broken or abusive home environments and turn to crime to survive? Oklahoma is ranked third in the U.S. in the dubious distinction of its incarceration rate, that is, the number of people in prison per 100,000 at well over 650 people per. The adult prison population arises in part from juvenile offenders, something we don't often talk about or like to discuss. My guest today, Brent Wolf, is the director of the Tulsa County Juvenile Bureau. With a background in social work, Wolf and his team work to provide counseling, structure, and advocacy to youth caught up in the legal system for criminal behavior. Through many varieties of innovative programming and multidisciplinary family education, the Bureau works to address the social and psychological needs of teens. He stopped by the studio to educate us about the work of providing justice to juveniles. Brent Wolf, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. Glad to have you here today. Tell me about the scope and footprint of the Tulsa County Bureau.
Tulsa County Juvenile Bureau is the treatment wing of the Tulsa District Court Juvenile Division. So we are held responsible for two-pronged community safety and the treatment of youth and families that are coming through our system.
So how many kids do you see, say, in an average year?
Last year we had about 2,000 individual youth coming through our system. That means they committed a crime in Tulsa County and then were referred to the Tulsa County Juvenile Bureau to begin that legal process.
And what's the age range on these kids?
We have some that are 11 years old, not a lot, up to 18, and the median age is 15, and that really is where we see most of our kids in the 14, 15, 16-year-old range.
And is it predominantly male kids, or is there an even breakdown?
It is predominantly male, approximately 75% male, 25% female, although that number has, for the past 10 years, shifted incrementally with the increase of more females into the system.
What's the breakdown on violent versus nonviolent offenses?
Out of those 2,000 offenses, the vast majority of them are offenses that, if they were categorized as an adult, they would all be misdemeanors. And approximately then, those felony charges would be maybe 500 out of those 2,000 a year.
So about a quarter.
Yeah.
Per se. And then we were talking a little bit before the interview. You told me that most of the caseload you have involves public defenders. So these are mostly low-income?
Mostly low-income families that are coming through. And also a vast majority of our youth come into our system with not just behavioral problems, but actual mental health issues. Majority of them have substance abuse issues, and most of them have mild to severe trauma in their life histories.
And from what I know about childhood trauma, this is usually a repetitive cycle throughout family structures. So if the children are being abused or experiencing trauma, typically one or both of their parents have also experienced that.
Usually, yes.
Something in the cycle
Absolutely.
Of trauma and poverty.
Right.
What are some of the most common myths that you come across or that you hear that you'd like to address the public in terms of dispelling about juvenile justice?
Probably the myth is that kids commit an offense and nothing ever really happens to them. And the reality is that, again, based on research, based on scientific evidence, what we now know about keeping a community safe has to do with the treatment that youth in the juvenile system are going to receive. And that treatment is, for the most part, going to be working with the family, trying to help the family figure out how they can create a structure that supports their children in a way that promotes success for them. And what we know doesn't work in terms of turning kids around and also creating community safety is the idea of punishment, and that somehow just locking kids up or monitoring them is going to change their behavior. It doesn't change their behavior, at least not in a positive direction. It doesn't mean that sometimes youth don't need to be placed in a secure facility, because they do, because we're not able to create a structure around them that allows for that safety variable that we're looking for. But the idea that you somehow punish kids and they get better is a myth. The reality is, if a youth does offend the community, there should be a consequence, definitely. We definitely want to say to that young person, you have offended your community, and we're going to get you here, and we're going to help you figure out how you pay the community back, and how do you not do this again.
And so, as the director of the Bureau, your job, in a sense, is to interface with the justice system in a reasonable way, but also to provide some kind of treatment to both facilitate rehabilitation, as it were, and prevent this from happening again. Is that fair
to say? Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. We are responsible back to the judicial side and the legal side. We do have a responsibility being able to report back to the court what is happening with this child. At the same time that we're reporting back to the court, what are our recommendations for treatment? So we're walking this line. On the one hand, it says, here are the laws, and here are the laws that you, young person and family, need to follow. At the same time, we're saying, and here's how we are going to help you best follow those laws.
So what's an example, or perhaps several examples, of treatment options you can offer instead of punishment that do help youngsters or families?
We are going to start with an assessment, and we're going to get basic information about who you are, where did you come from, how did you get to be the person you are, what's your family history, what's your academic history, what's your mental health history, what's your physical history. And based on all of the information that we gather through assessment, screening, sometimes complete psychological evaluations, we then are going to come up with a treatment plan and say, here's what we're going to work on with you. So we come up with a variety of ways that we can work with youth and families. And sometimes the probation counselor can do that, and it's enough. Frequently, we are going to need more intensity to work with kids, so we're going to have them involved in therapy and counseling. We also have an intensive family-based therapy program, which works with families intensively. Again, helping them develop skills, helping all of them develop skills that are going to hopefully promote this family in the right direction of positive behavior and successful behavior.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Our guest today is Brent Wolf, director of the Tulsa County Juvenile Bureau, and we're talking about alternatives to, really, to incarceration for young offenders. And you mentioned basically treating the family as much as you're treating the offender, because you're only going to be successful, I suppose, right, if you're able to help intervene in the whole family setting. Is that
true? Yeah, absolutely. Our understanding is that we will have this young person in our system for a year, 2 years, maybe three, but there's a time limit to how much time they're going to be in our system. And if we haven't then helped them and helped the family sustain some growth beyond working with us, then they're probably going to be back with us, and we don't want them to come back with us. So we're developing and working on skill building with the family as well as with the young person.
Now, sometimes these kids, these are difficult children who've been in problematic environments, and so I imagine it's hard for the parents, or maybe these are single-parent families, to be involved in terms of treatment because they are trying to make ends meet. And so how do you reconcile that when you're having difficulty achieving sort of an intervention with the entire family.
Well, to your first point, yes, these are challenging youth. Not all of them, but a lot of them are challenging. And again, our understanding of that, if we're looking at it from a perspective of who they are and how did they get to be the way they are, particularly from a trauma lens, that then allows us to put our interaction with them in a context. How do we best interact with you, young person, that reduces your oppositional behavior and increases your positive behavior? Again, we know how to do that. We've been able to see, not just through us, but again, through research, through lots of experiential therapy, of how we best do that. How do we not provoke that negative behavior, and how do we support the positive behavior? So we understand we're working with challenging youth. We also understand that a lot of times families, when they get to us, are pretty worn out. They're tired. They've tried to do whatever they know how to do. Our philosophy really about families, again, is, and this is probably one of the myths about kids in the juvenile system, is that they have bad parents. And we actually don't believe they have bad parents. We actually believe they have parents who care. And almost every one of our young people has a parent, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, someone who does care about them. That doesn't necessarily mean they have all the skills to do the best parenting in the world, but they do care. So we're starting with that premise of saying to the family, will you join with us to help your child? As opposed to starting with the premise, you're a really bad parent, and we just want to tell you how horrible you are. Because I always want people to think about this, that if even with your own children, not even if they've committed a crime or not, but even with our own daughter when she was a teenager, you know, if the teacher, if someone came to us and said, boy, you are really doing a horrible job at being a father and being a mother, I think we'd go, well, forget you. I don't care. We're not working with you. So we're really inviting parents in with the understanding, by the way, that you are in a judicial system. So on the one hand, you are being ordered by the court to be involved with us, but that still doesn't mean you necessarily will be compliant. So we are looking again at therapeutic ways of engaging this family. And then also really, what is it that you think would be most helpful, parent? What is it we can do that's going to help you be the best parent that you can be?
And you've been successful to a large extent. I mean,
We have been successful. Our latest study on recidivism, which is youth who have exited our system, we did a study and we looked at every youth that had exited our system for 2 years post their termination from the system. And in that 2-year period, we had a recidivism rate of 6.5%. And out of that 6.5%, about 3% came back once, and then the other 3.5 maybe multiple times. Relative to national averages, which are 20-25% recidivism, it actually is a good rate. It is those 3.5% that take up a lot of time, a lot of energy, and trying to really figure out how do we get creative and supportive at the same time.
So that's a tremendous success rate. So what factors, I know you don't know exactly what the answers are, but what things do you think lead to you having such a good result as far as not having as high a recidivism rate as, say, the national average?
I think we do use, for those youth on probation, really a wraparound model, which is let's look at this whole family system you're in and the community system you're in. And in that system, where are the strengths? What's working now? What do you have that really is helpful and really moving your family in the right direction? Where do you need some help with that? And so our goal and our responsibility is then, if we do that assessment accurately, we then try to find, all right, where are those critical, helpful points that we need to enter into this family? And not just say, all right, your kid committed a crime, you're now in the juvenile system, go do something about it. Probably if they could have done something about it, they would have. So if we don't take that responsibility of actively intervening with that family, we really can't expect that they're going to be able to change very much just on their own.
Now, you have some programs through which you've been successful in terms of helping kids graduate from high school.
Yeah, one of our really innovative and successful programs is our alternative school. It's a collaboration with Tulsa Public School. It's middle and high school combined for youth on probation. And the approach is, it's all individualized learning. Every student has an individualized learning plan and an individualized treatment plan. They also then, because they are on probation, the school works with the probation department, and they also may be, if they're, for instance, in our intensive family program, that therapist and those case managers may also be involved in this. So the concept is we are all working here together, as opposed to you go there for school, you go someplace else for therapy, you go someplace else for the court. We're trying to bring all this together, integrate it for the family, and basically say we are all working on this together. The essence of the school, and this actually is what the students say about it, the reason they come and show up is this may be the first time that they really have felt like somebody cared about them at school. Most of these students have been suspended or expelled or otherwise dropped out of public education. When we first started the school, everyone sort of said, oh, fine, go ahead, do it. They're not going to come. Well, once they figured out somebody did care about them, they came. It's still not without challenge. Coming to school doesn't mean they necessarily want to be sit in their desk and do everything that we're asking them to do, but they do come. And that's a beginning point. And it's our starting point to get them back involved in education, because it is probably one of the greatest predictive factors for success for any young person is can you complete your academic career or not?
That's really interesting. So where does that actually occur? I mean, is there a specified facility where
we do. Uh-huh. Tulsa Public Schools has Phoenix Rising in what was called the Lombard School. It's an old school building, but it's in good shape. At one time, people may remember Project 12, which was an alternative school of Tulsa Public Schools, and now Phoenix Rising is in that building.
Wow. And so do these kids graduate? I mean, is there a graduation rate that's you can
We don't actually have that. As when we started this program, we really were just saying we have kids not in school and we can't have it. It's just not allowed. They have to be engaged in something. And so in the beginning process, it really was, can we get them to come? And as we realized that they did want to be involved, they did want to be engaged, we then have continually had this program evolve from at one point maybe they were going to be involved with us for instance, while they were on probation. Then what we realized is that still a lot of those youth, either by choice, do not want to go back to a mainstream school, and also may not be ready to go back to a mainstream school. They still may not have those skills that would allow them to be successful in a regular public education setting. So we now have a combination of some youth who, yes, are going to stay there and they do want to graduate from Phoenix Rising, and some youth who may be there on a shorter term and actually can get credits and get skills that are going to allow them to go back into the mainstream public education system. So we have a combination of both of those.
But I like the way it's so thought out in terms of having not only the educational, literally milieu, the model and the location, but then you're talking about bringing the treatment modalities to bear as well as the probation and the judicial. So you're really making it centered on the learner, on the kid, him
Absolutely.
Or herself.
Yep.
I mean, that seems like if you were going to have success, it would be the best way to accomplish that. I wonder what happens in those scenarios in which you can't reach the family, or the family or the parent or parents have really washed their hands, or you find through your work, essentially, that the relationship between the child who's in trouble is so fractured, maybe beyond repair, with the parents. How do you interface then, say, with the foster system?
Those are probably most challenging youth to work with. And the number of those youth actually is increasing. And many of them don't have families. They have their immediate biological families, may be in prison, they may be dead, they may have had parental rights terminated. There's a number of reasons why immediate family may not be available for them, as well as extended family also not being there. And the difficulty with those young people is they also then may be in the child welfare system. But as you might expect, it is difficult to find families who would like to be foster parents for youth that are in the juvenile justice system. Understandably so. And again, these are challenging kids. And I never want to, I know sometimes I get off on this and people are going to say, oh God, he's a bleeding heart and you know, he thinks all these kids are okay. I do think they're all okay. I also think they're all mostly challenging. It's true. If someone breaks into my house, some teenager steals my car, I'm going to be just as mad as anybody else about it. But I still believe that as a community, we have this opportunity and responsibility to help turn that kid around, and that we can do it for the most part. Back to those youth with no families, it's a challenge, and it's hard, hard work. We actually are just in the very beginning process of putting together a program for what we call crossover youth. And those are youth that are both in the DHS welfare, child welfare system, and in the juvenile justice system. And what our focus is going to be is how do we bring those two systems together to better serve the best interest of these children? Because in the past, the systems have not worked particularly well together. But we have some individual cases right now that we've worked on together that are moving in the right direction. So we would like to begin to systemically look at that and see how do we institutionalize what could be best interest for kids that are in both systems.
Yeah, so you have kids that are in the DHS system for various reasons of rehabilitation or special needs or...
Well, they're in the DHS system because they somehow, parents and kinship are not available for them. I mean, that's the primary reason they're in DHS custody.
I see. And then but once they cross over into juvenile justice system, I suppose it would be easy for DHS to say, okay, it's over there now, it's your problem or something like that. But the point being,
it might be.
collaborating between the two bureaucracies, right. The two organizations would be very useful in terms of looking at the
It absolutely
at,
is.
At the client.
We both have expertise that we can bring to support the best interests of the child, and the better able we are to combine those expertise, the better chance this child's going to have.
Brent, you alluded earlier to research which looks at brain development of youth, and I think, you know, the sensational side of juvenile justice is when a minor, that is someone really less than 18, commits a very heinous crime. And I guess it's a twofold question. One is, what are the factors that go into determining when a young person is tried as an adult versus a youth? And then what does that research really tell us about really how we should think about that?
Research tells us what historically medical profession, psychological profession, social work profession for years and years since the turn of the century, into the 20th century, had some idea about. that adolescents are not the same as adults, that there is a difference there, and that we can see it behaviorally and we can understand it experientially. What we're now able to show in the past 20 years is that actually is true, and we can show that through brain research, that the brains of an adolescent are not the same as the brain of an adult. And certainly the emotional development of an adolescent is not the same as the emotional development of an adult. So we begin to see around 16 that brain development begins to slow down, but not totally. I mean, it still continues even into the 20s for most of us. What we also understand is that if that brain development gets interrupted at any point, it may then curtail the continual normal development, normal positive development of the brain. So you may get stuck with that. So everybody's listening and saying, well, I know a lot of 35-year-old men who act like 15-year-old boys. Some of that may be true, regardless of brain development, but it is true. They may be actually their development got interrupted, and there was an intervention that stopped that from occurring. So what does that tell us? Again, is that basically adolescents don't make the best decisions in the world because they don't have the capacity to make the best decisions in the world. As a community and a system, we then say, we understand that. We're going to help you continue to develop your skills, your brain, your body, so that you can eventually make these good decisions. What that means when you ask about sort of the heinous, most serious crimes is that those most serious crimes committed by an adolescent, which would be the ones that you would naturally expect are heinous, murder and severe violence, then those youth can be tried as adults. And although they have some rights as juveniles, they still are going to be tried in the adult system. And if found guilty, they will be put into the adult correctional system. One of the factors that has recently come up through court cases and now in the Supreme Court is this concept and evidence that adolescents, because of this whole development of the brain, of the emotional life of an adolescent, are still different than adults. Therefore, the Supreme Court for the first time has said that is why we cannot have capital punishment for adolescents, recognizing that difference.
Brent Wolf, I want to thank you so much for coming down today.
Thank you.
Brent Wolf is the director of the Tulsa County Juvenile Bureau. Well, that's our show for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed on Studio Tulsa are those of our guests and commentators and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.